This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Revival, a novel by Stephen King. Read by David Morse.
That is not dead which can eternal lie, and with strange eons even death may die. H.P. Lovecraft. Revival. Chapter 1. Fifth Business, Skull Mountain, Peaceable Lake. In one way, at least, our lives really are like movies. The main cast consists of your family and friends. The supporting cast is made up of neighbors, co-workers, teachers, and daily acquaintances. There are also bit players, the supermarket checkout girl with the pretty smile, the friendly bartender at the local watering hole, the guys you work out with at the gym 3 days a week. And there are thousands of extras, those people who flow through every life like water through a sieve, seen once and never again. The teenager browsing graphic novels at Barnes & Noble, the one you had to slip past, murmuring, "Excuse me," in order to get to the magazines. The woman in the next lane at a stoplight, taking a moment to freshen her lipstick. The mother wiping ice cream off her toddler's face in a roadside restaurant where you stopped for a quick bite. The vendor who sold you a bag of peanuts at a baseball game. But sometimes a person who fits none of these categories comes into your life. This is the Joker, who pops out of the deck at odd intervals over the years, often during a moment of crisis. In the movies, this sort of character is known as the fifth business, or the change agent. When he turns up in a film, you know he's there because a screenwriter put him there. But who is screenwriting our lives? Fate or coincidence? I want to believe it's the latter. I want that with all my heart and soul. When I think of Charles Jacobs, my fifth business, my change agent, my nemesis, I can't bear to believe his presence in my life had anything to do with fate. It would mean that all these terrible things, these horrors, were meant to happen. If that is so, then there is no such thing as light, and our belief in it is a foolish illusion. If that is so, we live in darkness like animals in a burrow, or ants deep in their hill, and not alone. Claire gave me an army for my 6th birthday, and on a Saturday in October of 1962, I was gearing up for a major battle. I came from a big family, 4 boys, 1 girl, and as the youngest, I always got lots of presents. Claire always gave the best ones. I don't know if it was because she was the eldest, because she was the only girl, or both. But of all the awesome presents she gave me over the years, that army was by far the best. There were 200 green plastic soldiers, some with rifles, some with machine guns, a dozen welded to tube-like gadgets she said were mortars. There were also 8 trucks and 12 jeeps. Perhaps the coolest thing about the army was the box it came in. A cardboard footlocker and camouflage shades of green and brown, with "Property of U.S. Army" stenciled on the front. Below this, Claire had added her own stenciling. Jamie Morton, Commander. That was me.
"I saw an ad for them in the back of one of Terry's comic books," she said when I was done screaming with delight. "He didn't want me to cut it out because he's a booger."
"That's right," Terry said. He was 8. "I'm a big brother, booger." He made a fork with his first 2 fingers and plugged his nostrils with them. "Stop it," our mother said. "No sibling rivalry on birthdays, please, and thank you, Terry. Take your fingers out of your nose."
"Anyway," Claire said, "I copied the coupon and sent it in. I was afraid it might not come in time, but it did. I'm glad you like it.
And she kissed me on the temple. She always kissed me there. All these years later, I can still feel those soft kisses.
I love it,
I said, holding the footlocker against my chest.
I'll love it forever.
This was after breakfast, which had been blueberry pancakes and bacon, my favorite. We all got our favorite meals on our birthdays, and the presents always came after breakfast, there in the kitchen with its wood stove and long table and our hulk of a washing machine, which was always breaking down. Forever for Jamie is like 5 days, Con said. He was 10, slender, although he bulked up later, and of a scientific bent even then. Nice one, Conrad, our father said. He was dressed for work in a clean coverall with his name, Richard, stitched in gold thread on the left breast pocket. On the right breast it said, Morton Fuel Oil. I'm impressed.
Thanks, Daddy-o.
Your silver tongue wins you the opportunity to help your mother clean up breakfast.
It's Andy's turn.
It was Andy's turn, Dad said, pouring syrup on the last pancake. Grab a dish towel, Silver Tongue, and try not to break anything.
You spoil him rotten, Con said, but he grabbed a dish towel.
Connie wasn't entirely wrong about my concept of forever. 5 days later, the operation game Andy gave me was gathering dust bunnies under my bed. Some of the body parts were missing anyway. Andy got it at the Eureka Grange rummage sale for a quarter. So were the jigsaw puzzles Terry gave me. Con himself gave me a Viewmaster. And that lasted a little longer, but it eventually wound up in my closet, never to be seen again. From Mom and Dad, I got clothes, because my birthday falls near the end of August, and that year I was going into first grade. I found new pants and shirts about as exciting as a TV test pattern, but tried to say thanks with enthusiasm. I imagine they saw through that with no trouble. False enthusiasm does not come easily to six-year-olds. Although, sad to say, it's a skill most of us learn fairly rapidly. In any case, the clothes were washed in the hulk, hung on the clothesline in the side yard, and finally folded away in my bureau drawers, where, it's probably needless to add, they were out of sight and mind until September came and it was time to put them on. I remember there was a sweater that was actually pretty cool. It was brown with yellow stripes. When I wore it, I pretended I was a superhero called the Human Wasp. Evildoers, beware my sting. But Con was wrong about the footlocker with the army inside. I played with those guys day in and day out, usually at the edge of the front yard, where there was a dirt strip between our lawn and Methodist Road, which was itself dirt in those days. With the exception of Route 9 and the two-lane leading to Goat Mountain, where there was a resort for rich people, all the roads in Harlow were dirt back then. I can remember my mother on several occasions weeping about all the dust that got into the house on dry summer days. Billy Paquette and Al Knowles, my two best friends, played army with me on many afternoons, but on the day Charles Jacobs appeared in my life for the first time, I was on my own. I don't remember why Billy and Al weren't with me, but I do remember I was happy to be by myself for a change. For one thing, there was no need to split the army into three divisions. For another, this was more important. I didn't have to argue with them about whose turn it was to win. In truth, it seemed unfair to me that I should ever have to lose, because they were my soldiers, and it was my footlocker. When I advanced this idea to my mother one hot, late summer day shortly after my birthday, she took me by the shoulders and looked into my eyes, a sure sign that I was about to receive another lesson in life. That it's mine business is half the trouble with the world, Jamie. When you play with your friends, the soldiers belong to all of you.
Even if we play fight different sides?
Even if. When Billy and Al go home for their dinner and you pack the soldiers back into the box,
it's a footlocker.
Right, the footlocker. When you pack them away, they're yours again. People have many ways to be lousy to one another, as you'll find out when you're older. But I think that all bad behavior stems from plain old selfishness. Promise me you'll never be selfish, kiddo. I promised,
but I still didn't like it when Billy and Al won. On that day in October of 1962, with the fate of the world dangling by a thread over a small tropical spit of land called Cuba, I was fighting both sides of the battle, which meant I was bound to come out on top. The town grader had been by earlier on Methodist Road, moving the rocks around, my dad always grumbled, and there was plenty of loose dirt. I scraped enough together to make first a hill, then a big hill, and then a very big hill, one that came up almost to my knees. At first I thought of calling it Goat Mountain, but that seemed both unoriginal, the real Goat Mountain was only 12 miles away after all, and boring. After consideration, I decided to call it Skull Mountain. I even tried to poke a couple of eye-like caves in it with my fingers, but the dirt was dry and the holes kept caving in. "Oh, well," I told the plastic soldiers tumbled in their footlocker, "the world is hard and you can't have everything." That was one of my father's favorite sayings, and with five kids to support, I'm sure he had reason to believe it. "There'll be pretend caves." I put half of my army on top of Skull Mountain, where they made a formidable crew. I especially liked the way the mortar guys looked up there. These were the Krauts, the American army I arranged at the edge of the lawn. They got all the jeeps and trucks, because they would look so groovy, charging up the steep slope of the mountain. Some would turn over, I was sure, but at least a few of them would make it to the top and run over the mortar guys, who would scream for mercy. They wouldn't get it. "To the death," I said, setting up the last few of the heroic Americans. "Hitzmer, you are next." I was starting them forward, rank by rank, and making comic book-style machine gun noises when a shadow fell over the battlefield. I looked up and saw a guy standing there. He was blocking the afternoon sun, a silhouette surrounded by golden light, a human eclipse. There was stuff going on. At our house on Saturday afternoons, there always was. Andy and Con were in our long backyard, playing three flies, six grounders with a bunch of their friends, shouting and laughing. Claire was up in her room with a couple of her friends, playing records on her Imperial Party Time turntable, The Locomotion, Soldier Boy, Palisades Park. There was hammering from the garage, too, as Terry and our dad worked on the old 51 Ford Dad called the Road Rocket, or the Project. Once I heard him call it a piece of shit, a phrase I treasured then and still use now. When you want to feel better, call something a piece of shit. It usually works. Plenty going on, but at that moment everything seemed to fall still. I know it's only the sort of illusion caused by a faulty memory, not to mention a suitcase loaded with dark associations, but the recollection is very strong. All of a sudden, there were no kids yelling in the backyard, no records playing upstairs, no banging from the garage, not a single bird singing. Then the man bent down, and the westering sun glared over his shoulder, momentarily blinding me. I raised a hand to shield my eyes. "Sorry, sorry," he said, and moved enough so I could look at him without also having to look into the sun. On top, he was wearing a black for church jacket and a black shirt with a notched collar. On the bottom, blue jeans and scuffed loafers. It was like he wanted to be two different people at the same time. At the age of 6, I put adults into 3 categories: young grown-ups, grown-ups, and old people. This guy was a young grown-up. He had his hands on his knees so he could look at the opposing armies. "Who are you?" I asked. "Charles Jacobs." The name was vaguely familiar. He stuck out his hand. I shook it right away because even at 6, I had my manners. All of us did. Mom and Dad saw to that. "Why are you wearing that collar with a hole in it?" "Because I'm a minister. When you go to church on Sundays from now on, I'll be there. And if you go to Thursday night MYF, I'll be there too." "Mr. Latour used to be our minister," I said, "but he died." "I know. I'm sorry." It's okay, though, because Mom said he didn't suffer, only went straight to heaven. He didn't wear a collar like that, though.
Because Bill Latour was a lay preacher. That means he was sort of a volunteer. He kept the church open when there was no one else to do it. That was very good of him.
I think my dad knows about you, I said. He's one of the deacons in the church. He gets to take up the collection. He has to take turns with other deacons, though.
Sharing is good, Jacob said. He got down on his knees beside me.
Are you going to pray?
The idea was sort of alarming. Praying was for church and Methodist Youth Fellowship, which my brothers and sister called Thursday Night School. When Mr. Jacob started it up again, this would be my first year, just like it was my first year at regular school.
If you want to talk with my dad, he's in the garage with Terry. They're putting a new clutch in the road rocket. Well, my dad is. Terry mostly hands him the tools and watches. He's 8. I'm 6. I think my mom might be in the back porch watching some guys play 3-fly-6-grounders.
Which we used to call roly bat when I was a kid, he said, and smiled. It was a nice smile. I liked him right away.
Yeah?
Uh-huh. Because you had to hit the bat with the ball after you caught it. What's your name, son?
Jamie Morton. I'm 6.
So you said.
I don't think anyone ever prayed in our front yard.
I'm not going to either. What I want is a closer look at your armies. Which are the Russians and which are the Americans?
Well, these ones on the ground are Americans, sure, but the ones on Skull Mountain are Krauts. The Americans have to take the mountain.
Because it's in the way, Jacob said. Beyond Skull Mountain lies the road to Germany.
That's right, and the head Kraut, Hitzmer.
The author of so many evils, he said.
Huh?
Nothing. Do you mind if I just call the bad guys Germans? Krauts seems kind of mean.
No, that's great. Krauts are Germans, and Germans are Krauts. My dad was in the war. Just the last year, though. He fixed trucks in Texas. Were you in the war, Mr. Jacobs?
Nope. I was too young. For Korea, too. How are the Americans going to take that hill, General Morton?
Charge it, I shouted. Shoot the machine guns. Pow, pow, pow. Brrr.
Then going down way low in my throat. A direct attack on the high ground sounds risky, General. If I were you, I'd split your troops. Like so. He moved half of the Americans to the left and half to the right. That creates a pincers movement, see? He brought his thumb and forefinger together. Drive on the objective from both sides.
Maybe,
I said. I like the idea of a head-on attack. Lots of bloody action. But Mr. Jacob's idea appealed to me just the same. It was sneaky. Sneaky could be satisfying.
I tried to make some caves, but the dirt's too dry.
So I see. He poked a finger into Skull Mountain and watched the dirt crumble and bury the hole. He stood up and brushed the knees of his jeans. I've got a little boy who'd probably get a kick out of your soldiers in another year or two.
He can play right now, if he wants to.
I was trying not to be selfish.
Where is he?
Still in Boston, with his mother. There's lots of stuff to pack up. They'll be here Wednesday, I think. Thursday at the latest. But Maury's still a little young for soldiers. He'd only pick them up and throw them around.
How old is he?
Just 2.
I bet he still pees his pants,
I yelled and started laughing. It probably wasn't polite, but I couldn't help it. Kids peeing their pants were just so funny. He does at that, Jacob said, smiling. But I'm sure he'll grow out of it. Your father's in the garage, you say?
Yeah.
Now I remembered where I had heard the man's name before. Mom and Dad at the supper table, talking about the new minister that was coming from Boston. Isn't he awfully young? My mother had asked. Yes, and his salary will reflect that, my dad replied, and grinned. They talked about him some more, I think, but I didn't pay any attention. And he was hogging the mashed potatoes. He always did. You try that enfilading maneuver, he said, starting away.
Huh?
Pincers, he said, tweezing his thumb and finger together again.
Oh, yeah, great.
I tried it,
It worked pretty good. The Krauts all died. The battle wasn't what I'd call spectacular, though, so I tried the frontal assault, with trucks and jeeps tumbling off the steep slope of Skull Mountain, plus Krauts tumbling off the back with death cries of despair. Mom, Dad, and Mr. Jacobs sat on the front porch while the battle raged, drinking iced tea and talking about churchy things. In addition to my dad being a deacon, my mom was in the ladies' auxiliary. Not the boss of it, but the next to boss. You should have seen all the fancy hats she had in those days. There must have been a dozen. We were happy then. Mom called my brothers and sister, along with their friends, to meet the new minister. I started to come too, but Mr. Jacobs waved me back, telling Mom we'd met already. "Battle on, General," he called. I battled on. Con, Andy, and their friends went out back again and played on. Claire and her friends went back upstairs and danced on, although my mother told her to turn the music down, please and thank you. Mr. and Mrs. Morton and the Reverend Jacobs talked on, and for quite a while. I remember often being surprised at how much adults could yak. It was tiring. I lost track of them because I was fighting the Battle of Skull Mountain over again in several different ways, and the most satisfying scenario, adapted from Mr. Jacobs' pincers movement, one part of the American army kept the Germans pinned down from the front, while the rest looped around and ambushed the Germans from behind.
"What is this?"
one of them cried, just before getting shot in the head. I was starting to get tired of it and was thinking of going in for a slice of cake, if Con and Andy's friends had left any, when that shadow fell over me on my battlefield again. I looked up and saw Mr. Jacobs, holding a glass of water. "I borrowed this from your mother. Can I show you something?"
"Sure."
He knelt down again and poured the water all over the top of Skull Mountain.
"It's a thunderstorm,"
I shouted and made thunder noises. "Uh-huh, if you like. With lightning. Now look." He poked out two of his fingers like devil horns and pushed them into the wet dirt. This time, the holes stayed. "Presto," he said. "Caves." He took two of the German soldiers and put them inside. "They'll be tough to root out, General, but I'm sure the Americans will be up to the job."
"Hey, thanks."
"Add more water if it gets crumbly again."
"I will."
"And remember to take the glass back to the kitchen when you finish the battle. I don't want to get in trouble with your mother on my first day in Harlow." I promised and stuck out my hand.
"Put it there, Mr. Jacobs."
He laughed and did so, then walked off down Methodist Road toward the parsonage where he and his family would live for the next 3 years, until he got fired. I watched him go, then turned back to Skull Mountain. Before I could really get going, another shadow fell over the battlefield. This time, it was my dad. He took a knee, being careful not to squash any American soldiers.
"Well, Jamie, what'd you think of our new minister?"
"I like him."
"So do I. Your mother does, too. He's very young for the job, and if he's good, we'll only be his starter congregation. But I think he'll do fine, especially with MYF. Youth calls to youth."
"Look, Daddy, he showed me how to make caves. You only have to get the dirt wet so it makes kind of almost mud."
"I see." He ruffled my hair. "You want to wash up good before supper." He picked up the glass. "Want me to take this in for you?"
"Yes, please and thank you."
He took the glass and headed back to the house. I returned to Skull Mountain, only to see the dirt had dried out again and the caves had collapsed. The soldiers inside had been buried alive. That was okay with me. They were the bad guys, after all. These days we've become gruesomely sensitized to sex, and no parent in his or her right mind would send a 6-year-old off in the company of a new male acquaintance who was living by himself, if only for a few days. But that is exactly what my mother did the following Monday afternoon, and without a qualm. Reverend Jacobs, Mom told me I was supposed to call him that, not Mister, came walking up Methodist Hill around 2:45 and knocked on the screen door. I was in the living room, coloring on the floor, while Mom watched dialing for prizes. She had sent her name into WCSH and was hoping to win that month's grand prize, an Electrolux vacuum cleaner. She knew the chances weren't good, but she said, "Hope springs infernal." That was a joke.
"Can you loan me your youngest for half an hour?" Reverend Jacobs asked. "I've got something in my garage that he might like to see."
"What is it?"
I asked, already getting up. "A surprise. You can tell your mother all about it later."
"Mom?"
"Of course," she said. "But change out of your school clothes first, Jamie. While he does that, would you like a glass of iced tea, Reverend Jacobs?"
"I would," he said. "And I wonder if you could manage to call me Charlie."
She considered this, then said, "No, but I could probably manage Charles." I changed into jeans and a T-shirt, and because they were talking about adult things when I came back downstairs, I went outside to wait for the school bus. Con, Terry, and I attended the one-room school on Route 9, an easy quarter-mile walk from our house. But Andy went to Consolidated Middle, and Claire all the way across the river to Gates Falls High, where she was a freshman. "Just don't be a fresh girl," Mom told her. That was also a joke. The bus dropped them off at the intersection of Route 9 and Methodist Road at the foot of Methodist Hill. I saw them get off, and as they came trudging up the hill, squabbling as always, I could hear them as I stood waiting by the mailbox. Reverend Jacobs came out. "Ready?" he asked and took my hand. It seemed perfectly natural.
"Sure,"
I said. We met Andy and Claire halfway down the hill. Andy asked where I was going.
"To Reverend Jacob's house,"
I said.
"He's going to show me a surprise."
"Well, don't be too long," Claire said. "It's your turn to set the table."
She glanced at Jacob's, then quickly away again, as if she found him hard to look at. My big sister had a wicked crush on him before the year was out, and so did all her friends. "I'll have him back shortly," Jacobs promised. We walked down the hill, hand in hand, to Route 9, which led to Portland, if you turn left, to Gates Falls, Castle Rock, and Lewiston, if you turn right. We stopped and looked for traffic, which was ridiculous since there were hardly any cars on Route 9 except in the summer, and then walked on past hayfields and cornfields, the stalks of the latter now dry and clattering in a mild autumn breeze. 10 minutes brought us to the parsonage, a tidy white house with black shutters. Beyond it was the First Methodist Church of Harlow, which was also ridiculous since there was no other Methodist church in Harlow. The only other house of worship in Harlow was Shiloh Church. My father considered the Shilohites moderate to serious weirdos. They didn't ride around in horse-drawn buggies or anything, but the men and boys all wore black hats when they were outside. The women and girls wore dresses that came down to their ankles and white caps. Dad said the Shilohites claimed to know when the world was going to end. It was written down in a special book. My mother said in America, everyone was entitled to believe what they liked as long as they didn't hurt anybody. But she didn't say Dad was wrong, either. Our church was bigger than Shiloh, but very plain. Also, it had no steeple. It did once, but a hurricane came along back in the olden days, 1920 or so, and knocked it down. Reverend Jacobs and I walked up the parsonage's dirt driveway. I was interested to see that he had a blue Plymouth Belvedere, a very cool car.
"Standard shift or push-button drive?"
I asked.
He looked surprised, then grinned.
"Push-button," he said. "It was a wedding present for my in-laws."
"Are in-laws like outlaws?"
"Mine are," he said, and laughed. "Do you like cars?"
"We all like cars,"
I said, meaning everyone in my family, although that was less true of Mom and Claire, I guessed. Females didn't seem to totally understand the basic coolness of cars.
"When the Road Rock is fixed up, my dad's going to race it at the Castle Rock Speedway."
"Really?"
"Well, not him, exactly. Mom said he couldn't because it's too dangerous, but some guy, maybe Dwayne Robichaud, he runs Brownie's store along with his mom and dad. He drove the 9 car at the Speedway last year, but the engine caught on fire. Dad says he's looking for another ride."
"Do the Robichauds come to church?"
"I'll
take that as a no. Come in the garage, Jamie."
It was shadowy and musty-smelling. I was a little afraid of the shadows and the smell, but Jacobs didn't seem to mind. He led me deeper into the gloom, then stopped and pointed. I gasped at what I saw. Jacobs gave a little chuckle, the way people do when they're proud of something. "Welcome to Peaceable Lake, Jamie."
"Wow."
"I got to set up while I'm waiting for Patsy and Maury to get here. I should be doing stuff in the house, and I have done a fair amount. Fixed the well pump, for one thing. But there's not a whole lot more I can do until Pats gets here with the furniture. Your mom and the rest of the ladies' auxiliary did a terrific job of cleaning the place up, kiddo. Mr. Latour commuted from Orr's Island, and no one's actually lived here since before World War II. I thanked her, but I wouldn't mind if you thanked her again."
"Sure, you bet," I said.
But I don't believe I ever passed that second thanks on, because I barely heard what he was saying. All my attention was fixed on a table that took up almost half the garage space. On it was a rolling green landscape that put Skull Mountain to shame. I've seen many such landscapes since, mostly in the windows of toy shops, but they all had complicated electric trains running through them. There was no train on the table Reverend Jacobs had set up, which wasn't a real table at all, but sheets of plywood on a rank of sawhorses. Atop the plywood was a countryside in miniature, about 12 feet long and 5 feet wide. Power pylons 18 inches high marched across it on a diagonal, and it was dominated by a lake of real water that shone bright blue even in the gloom. "I'll have to take it down soon," he said, "or else I won't be able to get the car in the garage. Patsy wouldn't care for that." He bent, planted his hands above his knees, and gazed at the rolling hills, the thread-like power lines, the big lake. There were plastic sheep and cows grazing near the water. They were considerably out of scale, but I didn't notice, and wouldn't have cared if I had. There were also lots of street lamps, which was a little peculiar, since there was no town and no roads for them to shine on. "I bet you could have quite a battle with your soldiers here, couldn't you?" "Yeah," I said. "I thought I could fight an entire war there." He nodded. "That can't happen, though, because in Peaceable Lake, everyone gets along and no fighting is allowed. In that way, it's like heaven. Once I get MYF going, I plan to move it to the church basement. Maybe you and your brothers would help me. The kids would like it, I think."
"They sure would," I said, then added something my father said. "You betcham bobcats."
He laughed and clapped me on the shoulder. "Now, do you want to see a miracle?"
"I guess," I said.
I wasn't actually sure I did. It sounded like it might be scary. All at once, I realized the two of us were alone in an old garage with no car in it, a dusty hollow that smelled as if it had been closed up for years. The door to the outside world was still open, but it seemed a mile off. I liked Reverend Jacobs okay, but I found myself wishing I had stayed home, coloring on the floor and waiting to see if Mom could win the Electrolux and finally get the upper hand in her never-ending battle with the summer dust. Then Reverend Jacobs passed his hand slowly above Peaceable Lake, and I forgot about being nervous. There was a low humming sound from under the makeshift table, like the sound our Philco TV made when it was warming up, and all the little streetlights came on. They were bright white, almost too bright to look at, and cast a magical, moony glow over the green hills and blue water. Even the plastic cows and sheep looked more realistic, possibly because they now cast shadows.
"Gosh, how did you do that?"
he grinned.
"Pretty good trick, huh?"
"God said, let there be light, and there was light, and the light was good. Only I'm not God, so I have to depend on electricity, which is wonderful stuff, Jamie. Such a gift from God that it makes us feel godlike every time we flip a switch, wouldn't you say?"
"I guess so," I said. "My Grandpa Amos remembers before there were electric lights."
"Lots of people do," he said. "But it won't be long before all those people are gone. And when that happens, nobody will think much about what a miracle electricity is and what a mystery. We have an idea about how it works, but knowing how something works and knowing what it is are two very different things.
How did you turn on the lights?
I asked. He pointed to a shelf beyond the table.
See that little red bulb?
Uh-huh.
It's a photoelectric cell.
You can buy them, but I built that one myself. It projects an invisible beam. When I break it, the street lights around Peaceable Lake go on. If I do it again, like so. He passed his hand above the landscape and the street lights dimmed, faded to faint cores of light, then went out. You see?
Cool,
I breathed.
You try it.
I reached my hand up. At first, nothing happened. But when I stood on tiptoe, my fingers broke the beam. The humming from beneath the table started up again, and the lights came back on.
I did it.
Betchin' bobcats, he said, and ruffled my hair.
What's that humming?
It sounds like our TV.
Look under the table. Here, I'll turn the overhead lights on so you can see better. He flipped a switch on the wall, and a couple of dusty hanging light bulbs came on. They did nothing about the musty odor, and I could smell something else as well now. Something hot and oily. But they banished some of the gloom. I bent. At my age, I didn't have to bend far, and looked beneath the table. I saw two or three boxy things strapped to the underside. They were the source of the humming sound, and the oily smell, too. Batteries, he said, which I also made myself. Electricity is my hobby, and gadgets. He grinned like a kid. I love gadgets. Drives my wife crazy.
My hobby's fighting the Krauts, I said.
Then remembering what he said about that being kind of mean. Germans, I mean. Everybody needs a hobby, he said, and everyone needs a miracle or two. Just to prove life is more than just one long trudge from the cradle to the grave. Would you like to see another one, Jamie?
Sure.
There was a second table in the corner, covered with tools, snips of wire, three or four dismembered transistor radios, like the ones Claire and Andy had, and regular store-bought C and D batteries. There was also a small wooden box. Jacobs took the box, dropped to one knee so we'd be on the same level, opened it, and took out a white-robed figure. Do you know who this is? I did, because the guy looked almost the same as my fluorescent nightlight.
Jesus? Jesus with a pack on his back?
Not just any pack. A battery pack. Look. He flipped up the top of the pack on a hinge not bigger than a sewing needle. Inside, I saw what looked like a couple of shiny dimes with tiny dots of solder on them. I made these, too, because you can't buy anything this small or powerful in the stores. I believe I could patent them. And maybe someday I will, but... He shook his head. Never mind. He closed the top of the pack again and carried Jesus to the Peaceable Lake landscape. I hope you noticed how blue the water is, he said.
Yeah, bluest lake I ever saw.
He nodded. Kind of a miracle in itself, you might say, until you take a close look.
Huh?
It's really just paint. I muse on that sometimes, Jamie, when I can't sleep. How a little paint can make shallow water seem deep. That seemed like a silly thing to think about, but I didn't say anything. Then he kind of snapped to and put Jesus down beside the lake. I plan to use this in MYF. It's what we call a teaching tool. But I'll give you a little preview, okay?
Okay.
Here's what it says in the 14th chapter of Matthew's Gospel. Will you take instruction from God's holy word, Jamie?
Sure.
I guess so, I said, starting to feel uneasy again. I know you will, he said, because what we learn as children is what sticks the longest. Okay, here we go. So, listen up. And straightaway Jesus constrained his disciples, that means he commanded them, to get into a ship and to go before him to the other side of the water while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up into a mountain to pray. Do you pray, Jamie?
Yeah, every night.
Good boy. Okay, back to the story. When evening was come, he was there alone, but the ship was now in the midst of the sea, tossed with waves, for the wind was contrary. And in the fourth watch Jesus went unto them, walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, It is a spirit. And they cried out for fear. But straightway Jesus spake unto them, saying, Be of good cheer. It is I. Be not afraid. That's the story. And may God bless his holy word. Good one, huh? I guess. Does spake mean he talked to them? It does, right? Right. Would you like to see Jesus walk on Peaceable Lake? Yeah, sure. He reached under Jesus' white robe, and the little figure began to move. When it reached Peaceable Lake, it didn't sink, but continued serenely on, gliding along the top of the water. It reached the other side in 20 seconds or so. There was a hill there, and it tried to go up, but I could see it was going to topple over. Reverend Jacobs grabbed it before it could. He reached under Jesus' robe again and turned him off.
He did it,
I said.
He walked on the water.
Well, he was smiling. But it wasn't a funny smile somehow. It turned down at one corner. Yes and no.
What do you mean?
See where he went into the water?
Yeah.
Reach in there. See what you find. Be careful not to touch the power lines because there's real electricity running through them. Not much, but if you brush them, you'd get a jolt. Especially if your hand was wet. I reached in, but cautiously. I didn't think he'd play a practical joke on me, as Terry and Con sometimes did. But I was in a strange place, with a strange man, and I wasn't completely sure. The water looked deep, but that was an illusion created by the blue paint of the reservoir and the lights reflecting on the surface. My finger only went in up to the first knuckle. You're not quite in the right place, Reverend Jacobs said. Go a little bit to your right. Do you know your right from your left? I did. Mama taught me. Right is the hand you write with. Of course, that wouldn't have worked with Claire and Con, who were what my dad called southpaws. I moved my hand and felt something in the water. It was metal with a groove on it. I think I found it, I told Reverend Jacobs. I think so, too. You're touching the track Jesus walks on.
It's a magic trick, I said.
I'd seen magicians on the Ed Sullivan Show, and Con had a box of magic tricks he got for his birthday, although everything but the floating balls and the disappearing egg had been lost. That's right.
Like Jesus walking in the water to that ship?
Sometimes, he said, that's what I'm afraid of. He looked so sad and distant that I felt a little scared again, but I also felt sorry for him. Not that I had any idea what he had to feel sad about, when he had such a neat pretend world, his Peaceable Lake and his garage. It's a really good trick, I said and patted his hand. He came back from wherever he had gone and grinned at me. You're right, he said. I'm just missing my wife and little boy, I guess. I think that's why I borrowed you, Jamie. But I ought to return you to your mom now. When we got to Route 9, he took my hand again, even though there were no cars coming either way, and we walked like that all the way up Methodist Road. I didn't mind. I liked holding his hand. I knew he was looking out for me. Mrs. Jacobs and Morris arrived a few days later. He was just a little squirt in dighties, but she was pretty. On Saturday, the day before Reverend Jacobs first stood in the pulpit of our church, Terry, Con, and I helped him move Peaceable Lake to the church basement, where Methodist Youth Fellowship would meet every Thursday night. With the water drained, the shallowness of the lake and the groove track running across it were very clear. Reverend Jacobs swore Terry and Con to secrecy, because, he said, he didn't want the illusion spoiled for the little ones, which made me feel like a big one, a sensation I enjoyed. They agreed, and I don't think either of them peached, but the lights in the church basement were much brighter than those in the parsonage garage. And if you stood close to the landscape and peered at it, you could see that Peaceable Lake was really just a wide puddle. You could see the groove track, too. By Christmas, everyone knew.
"It's a big old fakeroony,"
Billy Paquette said to me one Thursday afternoon. He and his brother Ronnie hated Thursday night school, but their mother made them go.
"If he shows it off one more time and tells us they're walking a water story, I'm going to puke."
I thought of fighting him over that, but he was bigger. Also my friend. Besides, he was right. Chapter 2. 3 years. Conrad's voice. A miracle. Reverend Jacobs got fired because of the sermon he gave from his pulpit on November 21st, 1965. That was easy to look up on the internet, because I had a landmark to go by. It was the Sunday before Thanksgiving. He was gone from our lives a week later, and he went alone. Patsy and Morris, dubbed Tagalong Maury by the kids in MYF, were already gone by then. So was the Plymouth Belvedere with a push-button drive. My memory of the 3 years between the day when I first saw Peaceable Lake and the day of the terrible sermon are surprisingly clear. Although before beginning this account, I would have told you I remembered little. After all, I would have said, how many of us remember the years between 6 and 9 in any detail? But writing is a wonderful and terrible thing. It opens deep wells of memory that were previously capped. I feel I could push aside the account I set out to write and instead fill a book, and not a small one, about those years and that world, which is so different from the one I live in now. I remember my mother, standing at the ironing board in her slip, impossibly beautiful in the morning sunshine. I remember my saggy-seated bathing suit, an unattractive Loden green, and swimming in Harry's Pond with my brothers. We used to tell each other the slimy bottom was cow shit, but it was just mud, probably just mud. I remember drowsy afternoons in the one-room West Harlow school, sitting on winter coats and spelling corner and trying to get poor, stupid Dickie Osgood to get giraffe right. I even remember him saying, why should I have to spell one when I'll never see one? I remember the webwork of dirt roads that crisscrossed our town, and playing marbles in the schoolyard during frigid April recesses, and the sound the wind made in the pines as I lay in my bed, prayers said, and waiting for sleep. I remember my father coming out of the garage with a wrench in his hand, and his Morton fuel oil cap pulled low on his forehead, blood oozing through the grease on his knuckles. I remember watching Ken McKenzie introducing Popeye cartoons on the Mighty 90 show, and how I was forced to give up the TV on the afternoons when Claire and her friends arrived, because they wanted to watch American Bandstand and see what the girls were wearing. I remember sunsets as red as the blood on my father's knuckles, and how that makes me shiver now. I remember 1,000 other things, mostly good ones, but I didn't sit down at my computer to put on rose-colored glasses and wax nostalgic. Selective memory is one of the chief sins of the old, and I don't have time for it. They were not all good things. We lived in the country, and back then, country life was hard. I suppose it still is. My friend Al Knowles got his left hand caught in his father's potato grater and lost 3 fingers before Mr. Knowles could get the bulky, dangerous thing turned off. I was there that day, and I remember how the belts turned red. I remember how Al screamed. My father, along with Terry, his faithful, if clueless, acolyte, got the road rocket running. God, what a gorgeous, blasting clatter it made when he revved the engine and turned it over to Dwayne Robichaux, newly painted and with the number 19 emblazoned on its side, to race at the Speedway in Castle Rock. In the first lap of the first heat, the idiot rolled it and totaled it. Dwayne walked away without a scratch. "Accelerator pedal must have stuck," he said, grinning his foolish grin. only he said accelerator, and my father said the only ass was the one behind the wheel. That will teach you to ever trust anything valuable to a Robichaux, my mother said. And my father stuffed his hands so deep into his pockets that the top of his underwear showed, perhaps to ensure they would not escape and go someplace they weren't supposed to. Lenny McIntosh, the postman's son, lost an eye when he bent down to see why the cherry bomb he'd put in an empty pineapple tin didn't go off. My brother Conrad lost his voice. So, no, they weren't all good things. On the first Sunday that Reverend Jacobs took the pulpit, there were more people present than had been there in all the years fat, white-haired, good-natured Mr. Latour had kept the church open, preaching his well-meant but obscure sermons and reliably welling up at the eyes on Mother's Day, which he called Mother's Sunday. These details came courtesy of my own mother, years later. I barely remembered Mr. Latour at all. Instead of 20 congregants, there were easily four times that number. And I remember how their voices soared during the doxology. Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Praise him, ye creatures, here below. It gave me goosebumps. Mrs. Jacobs was no slouch on the pedal organ either, and her blonde hair, held back with a plain black ribbon, glowed many colors in the light falling through our only stained glass window. Walking home from church en famille, our good Sunday shoes kicking up little puffs of dust, I found myself just behind my parents, so heard Mom expressing her approval, also her relief. I thought, him being so young and all, we'd get a lecture on civil rights or banning the draft or something like that, she said. Instead, we got a very nice Bible-based lesson. I think people will come back, don't you? For a while, my father said. She said, oh, the big oil baron, the big cynic, and punched his arm playfully. As it turned out, they were both sort of right. Attendance at our church never slumped back to Mr. Latour levels, which meant as few as a dozen in winter, huddled together for warmth in the drafty, wood-stove-heated church. But it dropped slowly to 60, then 50, and finally to 40 or so, where it hovered like the barometer on a changeable summer day. No one ascribed the attrition to Mr. Jacobs' preaching, which was always clear, pleasant, and Bible-based. Never anything troubling about A-bombs or freedom marches. Folks just kind of drifted away. God isn't as important to people now, my mother said one day after a particularly disappointing turnout. A day will come when they'll be sorry for that. During those 3 years, our Methodist Youth Fellowship also underwent a modest renaissance. In the Latour era, there were rarely more than a dozen of us on Thursday nights, and four were named Morton, Claire, Andy, Con, and Terry. In the Latour era, I was considered too young to attend, and for this, Andy sometimes used to give me head noogies and call me a lucky duck. When I asked Terry once what it was like back then, he gave a bored shrug. We sang songs and did Bible drills and promised we'd never drink intoxicating liquor or smoke cigarettes. Then he told us to love our mothers, and the Catholics are going to hell because they worship idols, and Jewish people love money. He also said to imagine Jesus is listening if any of our friends tell dirty jokes. Under the new regime, however, attendance swelled to 36 kids between 6 and 17, which necessitated buying more folding chairs for the church basement. It wasn't Reverend Jacob's mechanical Jesus toddling across Peaceable Lake. The thrill of that wore off rapidly, even for me. I doubt if the pictures of the Holy Land he put up on the walls had much to do with it either. A lot of it was his youth and enthusiasm. There were games and activities as well as sermons, because, as he pointed out regularly, most of Jesus' preaching happened outside, and that meant there was more to Christianity than church. The Bible drills remained, but we did them while playing musical chairs. And quite often someone fell on the floor while searching for Deuteronomy 14, verse 9, or Timothy 2, 12. It was pretty comical. Then there was the ball diamond, which Con and Andy helped him create out back. On some Thursdays, the boys played baseball, and the girls cheered us on. On alternate Thursdays, it was the girls playing softball, and the boys, hoping some of the girls would forget it was their turn and come in skirts, cheering them on. Reverend Jacob's interest in electricity often played a part in his Thursday night youth talks. I remember one afternoon when he called our house and asked Andy to wear a sweater on Thursday night. When we were all assembled, he called my brother to the front of the room and said he wanted to demonstrate the burden of sin. "Although I'm sure you're not much of a sinner, Andrew," he added. My brother smiled nervously and said nothing. "This isn't to frighten you kids," he said. "There are ministers who believe in that kind of thing, but I'm not one of them. It's just so you'll know." This, I've learned, is the kind of thing people say just before they try to scare the living crap out of you. He blew up a number of balloons and told us to imagine that each one weighed 20 pounds. He held the first up and said, "This one is telling lies." He rubbed it briskly on his shirt a few times and then held it against Andy's sweater, where it stuck as if it were glued there. "This one is theft." He stuck another balloon to Andy's sweater. "Here's anger." I can't remember for sure, but I think it likely he stuck 7 balloons in all to Andy's homemade reindeer sweater, one for each of the deadly sins. "That adds up to over 100 pounds of sin," he said. "A lot to carry. But who takes away the sins of the world?" "Jesus," we dutifully chorused. "Right. When you ask him for forgiveness, here's what happens." He produced a pin and popped the balloons, one after another, including one that drifted free and needed to be stuck back on. I think we all felt the balloon popping part of the lesson was quite a bit more exciting than the sanctified static electricity part. His most impressive demonstration of electricity in action involved one of his own inventions, which he called Jacob's Ladder. It was a metal box, about the size of the footlocker my toy army lived in. 2 wires that looked like TV rabbit ears jutted up from it. When he plugged it in, this invention ran on wall current rather than batteries, and flipped the switch on the side, long sparks, almost too bright to look at, climbed the wires. At the top, they peaked and disappeared. When he sprinkled some powder above this device, the climbing sparks turned different colors. It made the girls ooh with delight. This also had some sort of religious point, at least in the mind of Charles Jacobs it did, but I'll be damned if I remember what it was. Something about the Divine Trinity, maybe? Once the Jacobs ladder wasn't right there in front of us, the colored sparks rising and the current fizzing like an angry tomcat, such exotic ideas had a tendency to fade away like a transient fever. Yet I remember one of his mini lectures very clearly. He was sitting on a chair that was turned around so he could face us over the back. His wife sat on the piano bench behind him, hands folded demurely in her lap, head slightly bowed. Maybe she was praying. Maybe she was just bored. I know that a lot of his audience was. By then, most of the Harlow Methodist youth had begun to tire of electricity and its attendant glories. "Kids, science teaches us that electricity is the movement of charged atomic particles called electrons. When electrons flow, they create current, and the faster the electrons flow, the higher the voltage. That's science, and science is fine, but it's also finite. There always comes a point where knowledge runs out. What are electrons exactly?" "Charged atoms," the scientists say. "Okay, that's fine, as far as it goes. But what are atoms?" He leaned forward over the back of his chair. His blue eyes, they themselves looked electric, fixed on us. "No one really knows. And that's where religion comes in. Electricity is one of God's doorways to the infinite." "I wish he'd bring in an electric chair and fry up some white mice," Billy Paquette sniffed one evening after the benediction. "That would be interesting." In spite of the frequent and increasingly boring lectures on holy voltage, Most of us looked forward to Thursday night school. When he wasn't on his hobby horse, Reverend Jacobs could give lively, sometimes funny talks with lessons drawn from Scripture. He talked about real-life problems we all faced, from bullying to the temptation to cheat answers from someone else's paper during tests we hadn't studied for. We enjoyed the games, we enjoyed most of the lessons, and we enjoyed the singing, too, because Mrs. Jacobs was a fine pianist who never dragged the hymns. She knew more than hymns, too. On one never-to-be-forgotten night, she played a trio of Beatles songs, and we sang along with From Me to You, She Loves You, and I Want to Hold Your Hand. My mother claimed that Patsy Jacobs was 70 times better on the piano than Mr. Latour, and when the minister's young wife asked to spend some of the church collection money on a piano tuner from Portland, the deacons approved the request unanimously.
"But perhaps no more Beatles songs," Mr. Kelton said. He was the deacon who had served Harlow Methodist the longest. "The children can get that stuff on the radio. We'd prefer you to stick to more, Christian melodies."
Mrs. Jacobs murmured her agreement, eyes demurely cast down. There was something else as well. Charles and Patsy Jacobs had sex appeal. I've mentioned that Claire and her friends were gaga for him. It wasn't long before most of the boys had crushes on her as well, because Patsy Jacobs was beautiful. Her hair was blonde, her complexion creamy, her lips full, her slightly up-tilted eyes were green, and Connie claimed she had witchly powers, because every time she happened to shift those green eyes his way, his knees turned to water. With those kind of looks, there would have been talk if she had worn more makeup than a decorous blush of lipstick. But at 23, that was all she needed. Youth was her makeup. She wore perfectly proper knee- or shin-length dresses on Sundays, even though those were the years when ladies' hemlines started their climb. On MYF Thursday nights, she wore perfectly proper slacks and blouses, ship and shore, according to my mother. But the moms and grandmoms in the congregation watched her closely, just the same, because the figure those perfectly proper clothes set off was the kind that made my brother's friends sometimes roll their eyes or shake a hand the way you do after touching a stove burner someone forgot to turn off. She played softball on girls' nights, and I once overheard my brother Andy, who would have been going on 14 at the time, I think, say that watching her run the bases was a religious experience in itself. She was able to play the piano on Thursday nights and participate in most of the other MYF activities because she could bring her little boy along. He was a biddable, easy child. Everyone liked Maury. To the best of my recollection, even Billy Paquette, that young atheist in the making, liked Maury, who hardly ever cried, even when he fell down and skinned his knees. The worst he was liable to do was sniffle, and even that would stop if one of the bigger girls picked him up and cuddled him. When we went outside to play games, he followed the boys everywhere he could. And when he was unable to keep up with them, he followed the girls, who also minded him during Bible study or swung him around to the beat during sing time, hence the nickname Tag-Along Maury. Claire was particularly fond of him, and I have a clear memory, which I know must be made up of many overlaid memories, of them in the corner where the toys were, Maury in his little chair, Claire on her knees beside him, helping him to color or to construct a domino snake. "I want four just like him when I get married," Claire told my mother once. She would have been going on 17 by then, I suppose, and ready to graduate from MYF. "Good luck on that," my mother replied. "In any case, I hope yours will be better looking than Maury, Claire Bear." That was a tad unkind, but not untrue. Although Charles Jacobs was a good-looking man, and Patsy Jacobs was a downright beautiful young woman, Tag-Along Maury was as plain as mashed potatoes. He had a perfectly round face that reminded me of Charlie Brown's. His hair was a nondescript shade of brunette. Although his father's eyes were blue and his mother's that entrancing green, Maury's were plain old brown. Yet the girls all loved him, as if he were a starter child for the ones they would have in the following decade, and the boys treated him like a kid brother. He was our mascot. He was Tag-Along Maury. One February Thursday night, my four siblings and I came back from the parsonage with our cheeks red from sledding behind the church. Reverend Jacobs had set up electric lights along our run, singing I'm Henry VIII at the top of our lungs. I remember that Andy and Con were in a particularly hilarious mood because they brought our toboggan and put Maury on a cushion at the front, where he rode fearlessly and looked like the figurehead on the prow of a ship. You guys like those meetings, don't you? My father asked. I think there was mild wonder in his voice.
Yeah, I said. We did about 1,000 Bible drills tonight, and then went out back on our sleds. Mrs. Jacobs, she sledded too, only she kept falling off.
I laughed, and he laughed with me. That's great. But are you learning anything, Jamie?
Man's will should be an extension of God's will, I said, parroting that night's lesson. Also, if you connect the positive and negative terminals of a battery with a wire, it makes a short circuit.
True, he said, which is why you always have to be careful when you're jump-starting a car, but I don't see any Christian lesson in that.
It was about how doing something wrong, because you thought it might make something else better, doesn't work.
Ooh. He picked up the latest issue of Car and Driver, which had a cool Jaguar XKE on the cover. Well, you know what they say, Jamie. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, he thought for a moment, then added, and lit with electric lights. That made him laugh, and I laughed with him, even though I didn't get the joke. If it was a joke. Andy and Con were friends with the Ferguson brothers, Norm and Hal. They were what we called Flatlanders, or folks from away. The Fergusons lived in Boston, so the friendship was ordinarily restricted to summer vacations. The family had a cottage on Lookout Lake, only a mile or so from our house,